never go back to the village. And I say that's wrong. If 7J is upheld, no matter who takes control of that corporation, they got to pump annually 50% into the village. So that was one means of trying to protect the villages. We wanted the villages to have title to the subsurface. Congress didn't want to see that. They were worried about that. They felt that there would be too much diversion. Okay, 7I, we wrote that in so there would be no poverty pockets, because we, from the little renew of the resource, there's timber in southeast, there's timber along the drainages, there's fish on the coast, there's oil maybe in Costa and Point Barrow and maybe somewhere else. There's certain other mining minerals, asbestos, gold, silver, whatever, in other places. So, but there are places that don't have anything. You know, you take some of the barren country on the slope, or in western Alaska, down the Yukon Peninsula, there might not be oil. There might not be, they can't grow timber. They can't grow gardens. You know, it's tundra, too cold, permafrost. They're not accessible to good fishing. There's no mining. The mountains are all buried in thousands of feet of overburden. So what are they going to have for an economic base? What they'd have to do is move out. But with this 7I and 7J, there'll be a continuous cash flow to maintain themselves, and they could continue their subsistence 50-50 and continue their own lifestyle in a modern way, have enough money to do it without becoming a burden to government welfare, etc.
What effect does those corporations merging is that 50% pumped back to the corporation?
7J would become moot if they merge, insofar as their region having to share the revenue, they would be all one, so they wouldn't share. But they would still have to share 7I with the other regions. If they merge, those corporations are dissolved, the village corporations, and there's only one corporation. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
Would state police or game officers or anything related to enforcement and whatnot, would they have the right to enter that 40 million acres without a warrant eventually and set it up and it can determine? I mean, it seems to me like I look at land where, you know, if I own a half acre for a house, nobody's going to enter that half acre without my permission without a warrant, and I'll hold them off of it. Will that same right be associated with a volume as large as 40 million acres where you can say, okay, state troopers, you might think we're doing this, but unless you get a judge that says, yes, we are, then you can't get a warrant and you can't enter to find out anyway.
That's true. Technically, they can't enter that property. They'd be trespassing into that property without a warrant.
Because that could really fluctuate the meaning of subsistence, or at least on the land that is then owned, because there would be absolutely no way whatsoever to do any type of enforcement or anything like that.
On that score, it all depended in part on when you accepted the conveyance. Like some of the early conveyances were made with easements and rights of way and maybe corridors, you see, you know, along certain waterways and lakes and whatnot. In those instances, you know, there'd be accessibility. And of course, that's been one of the big sticking points and arguing points that we've had with the Interior Department in conveying land, because we always felt that, you know, Christ said, if we got our land, then it's our land. I mean, why shouldn't we use it the way we want? I mean, you don't go just walking onto the King Ranch, in Texas. Right now, in the conveying of land, the whole question of the clean title is still up in the air. You know, the federal government doesn't want to go in there and do all the work necessary to clean up those old mining claims and stuff. We won't accept that land without a key.
The tax thing has been extended to only affect the data transfer of private taxes. It wasn't 7191 for the tax.
Yeah.
Okay, that's been extended to 20 years after the data transfer.
I'm not sure. Is that the amendment?
There are some amendments that we tried to creep up our position on that, you know, both with respect to the taxation through the land bank type deal, and also the stock information type deal, regional test.
I haven't seen the language of that amendment, if it has passed. I knew that they were talking about it, I knew it was under consideration and all, but for some reason I had thought that it didn't, that it was attached to the D2 measure, and that it didn't pass, but I haven't read that D2 legislation.
Well, isn't it just going to be, it's not in the land, it's just on the corporate income.
No, it would be...
Right now we are taxed on our corporate income.
Anyway.
You know, right from the start we have said we're treated pretty much as any other business corporation. But we've always been concerned about the tax on land because of the potential for losing it.
That's just if you do this in legislation.
Well, the state right now, legislature is considering what they call an inventory tax. They could wipe you out tomorrow. The IRA won't allow that, and you're protected by the federal government. And also in an IRA, tribal members that derive their income off of their own land do not have to pay federal income tax. And they don't have to pay any federal income tax on money that the federal corporation makes on the federal land, I mean on the tribal land.
You know, the whole issue of taxation is pretty much untested on on beneficized land. theoretically, like on Fetlin, when they have the gas line going across there, instead of just taxing the land the gas line's on, they can tax the gas going through.
Technically, if Venati had proper counsel, and I'm not criticizing the Tanana chiefs, but they're not doing their job. If they had legal counsel, if they had proper representation, they could tax the pipeline, and they could lease the land, and they could get a revenue from the pipeline for the tribe, and nobody could touch it. They could tax on each side, but they couldn't tax that land. And if the Tanana people, under advice of counsel or through Tanana chiefs, get took on that, I'll intervene personally.
in the state, there's no property tax without the new oil revenue. Now, what if the state, say, both didn't come out or something, and the state didn't have as much of an income from the oil, and they decided to go ahead and retax and make it kind of property tax?
They could, that's what we're worried about. But under the state's structure, as I understand it, they have authorized the boroughs to tax, you see. So you can't be taxed twice by two entities. So if the borough is going to tax, you know, property taxes, then the state can't. But the state would have to find it some other way. So what they would probably do is impose a tax like they're talking about a resource inventory or they might have a severance tax for subsurface, et cetera, because the borough doesn't get the subsurface.
Who's proposing that tax inventory?
I forget who it was, but it's...
It's in the data.
Well, it's been considered for several years. I don't know that it's being specifically considered at this time, but I know that it had been considered on several occasions.
Who said that up there, last year, they really center to behind the American Indian as far as going the extent of Indian law. Do you think it's time that the villages start realizing and exercising their sovereign power?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, they're much too far behind. They got to make up for that whole period that's been lost back before World War II, which is really when they first came to be. You know, they didn't even have a school in Venati until 1938. You know, that was the threshold of the war years.
Is it possible to make a borough? You talked about making a borough and doing it yourself. Could you make a borough out of like that 40 million acres?
Yeah, but borough, you can't be racist. A borough, you have to accept anybody. So if Japanese industry moved in and they moved 10,000 aliens into the North Slope, and 2 years or 3 years they became citizens, they would run the borough. That's what happened in Pearl Harbor. You go to Pearl Harbor now, you go to Hawaii, and the Japanese have complete control of the whole naval facility in Pearl Harbor. But they're American citizens. You can't deny them that. but they're industrious and they want to stay there, you know. So they could walk from office to office to office, and they all got Japanese people working in them. The city and county of Honolulu, completely controlled, public works, completely controlled by Japanese and Chinese and Hawaii. I'm not criticizing that. A lot of people want to live there, let them live there. What I'm saying is the natives would not be autonomous, and they would not be able to carry on their own culture, make their own laws if they formed a borough. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't. Maybe they would rather do that. I don't think it's proper. I think that, you know, it's a funny world, but if you take, for an example, Marxism versus Stalinism or Hitlerism, democracy, whatever, there's nothing wrong with the United States preserving the original forms of government, so long as it doesn't interfere with others. So if the natives of America want to practice their culture literally on their land without interfering with anybody else, they ought to have that right. It's a sovereign right, like each state is a sovereign. And like one state wants to be a farm state, then let them farm. One state wants to be an industrial state, let them be an industrial state. Farm state don't want to have taxes, fine, they don't have to have taxes. Industrial state wants taxes, fine, but don't let them tax the farm state for their pollution. You see what I'm getting at? Federalism is a dangerous thing. The federal government coming in over everything, pretty soon you got one government. Pretty soon there are no states' rights, there are no borough rights, there are no Indian rights, there's nothing. Then you've got what? Imperialism? And that's where the United States is headed. They're headed for direct imperialism, totally in violation of the Constitution. The Attorney General, Abram Gross, sat and watched him in the courtroom when they were talking about that Buford C sale. And he said, if the Commissioner of Public Works, Commissioner of Natural Resources, erred in the way he put this bid package together for that, it was just a little illegal. And after all, there's nothing wrong with that. And after all, 100 years of case law supersedes the Constitution of the United States. Now that man stood, took the oath, swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state, and he sits in a courtroom, a court of law, and says, case law supersedes the Constitution that he swore to uphold, there's something wrong. Now Indians have a tendency, fortunately, to preserve the status quo and to preserve the integrity of the Constitution. Let them wipe out the Indians and the Indian way of thinking. Well, they don't want that. They want to be live and let live, and you're going to go all the way in anarchy. There will be a blood revolution in this country. That's my view.
Well, Don, you know, one of the things that we have seen in going through this course is that from the 1600s on, there was no apparent way to for this country, because of whatever was in their minds, to accept the idea, you know, of allowing the Indian to exist. I mean, there were pockets of them that did, but by far a large number didn't. Right? And it was because of some mistakes on their part, maybe, that they agreed that the treaties were the law of the land, right? That these early treaties that they made, which they cut off as soon as they could,
yeah,
right, in 1871. So it was of necessity that they, in effect, agreed to allow these sort of sovereign nations within their midst to exist, but then they began attempting to strip away all their sovereignty, their, you know, and their own control of their own area and including by their own law. And of course, the way I see it, the situation we have in Alaska is like the final product of this effort not to have to concede to allow people who are already there with their own form of government, you know, and laws
That's exactly true. And if you really bring it back to that time and think about it, there were hundreds of individual governments on North America and South America. And when the first pilgrims came over and established a colony, when they got big enough, they recognized five of them, they called five civilized tribes. When they first hit, they were savages, right? If they shot at them because they stole from them, they were savages, right? But as long as they were the minority, they were civilized. It would be no different than the same people going to India, they recognize those. Be no different than them going to Japan, they recognize those. So it's inconceivable that human beings, thinking human beings, could say that there were not nations here existing. Okay, when they drafted the Northwest Ordinance and they said that the Indians will never be disturbed in their use and possession of the land, and that that as new territory opened up, anytime 60,000 or more people wanted to create a state, they could do so. They never gave the Indians the opportunity to do that. The Indians probably would have done it. They never gave them that opportunity. And the more populated they got, the more dominating they became. And when they drafted the Constitution, they said that all states will be admitted on an equal footing. They didn't allow the Western states in on an equal footing. They didn't allow Alaska in on an equal footing. There's a terrible disparity between the thinking where they do what they want to do from afar. It's typical of England and France, and that's the cause of the Declaration of Independence, that's the cause of the Revolution. If Washington continues to do that, you can be assured that there will be a revolution in this country. If Washington will recognize the independent sovereignty of each state and each Indian nation, everybody can live harmonious. What's the difference what's wrong with the Indians having their own law? What's wrong with it? What makes it so great to let colored people and yellow people and white people go together and make a state and make their laws and everything? Why do they prohibit the Eskimo Indian Aleut from doing it? It's inconsistent. It borders on ridiculous. It's inconceivable in a system that we have devised called the United States government. And a treaty is the supreme law of the land. There's no question about that. I mean, that's a constitutional position that will never be changed. If they change that, then no treaty on earth is going to be worth its salt in America.
Of course, Doug, do you think that, there's got to be a reason for this unwillingness to allow other people to practice their own, after all, the people that survived for thousands of years up there in their own way. What do you think was the reason for the inability to allow that to continue?
Economic exploitation, greed, multinational attempt at control. They're not only doing that here. People think that it's unique to us, but look what they're doing in Central America. Look what they're doing in Vietnam. It's divide and conquer. Economic exploiters, multinationals, they know that they need a storehouse of raw material. And they know they got to preserve that. And they couldn't possibly preserve that if they had to come to you. You'd end up like, OPEC nations. The Indians, Eskimos, Aleuts would say, "Hey, fellas, if you want our oil, come and get it. Well, it's $5 a barrel or $5 a gallon or whatever. We'll sell it to you, but in the meantime, go someplace else." They could get tough that way.
Don't allow them up there. They're restricted area, and they're can be thrown in jail for doing it. back in the military a little bit, since it was, they had been doing this long before this military base, I guess, radar or something like that. It's the highest mountain there, so they put a base there, radar, Russia or something like that, and they pulled every, all the Indians, and it broke the mission, you know, years and years of time. What chance do you think of them regaining this position?
Pretty remote. I know exactly what you're talking about because I spent half my kid life running up and down the hill looking at the midnight sun every year. And that's the FAA has got an instrument approach system up there, and the military has some stuff there that's clear. When the military takes something, they, legally and technically they can take it. But the way it works is the military, under the United States Constitution, cannot own property. They cannot own an, any more than a 10 square miles. That's the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C. That's not owned by any state. That's not owned by any state. That's an independent district for the seat of government, where representatives from all the states come and all nations come to do business. Okay? The federal government, under the Constitution, is authorized to take for public necessity land for defense purposes, for common use of the people, transportation corridors, highway systems, railroads, canals, things like that. But they can't own it, so the Army doesn't own it. But what they do is they sort of get a lease from themselves. Actually, it's kind of a lease from the people. And they condemn the property and they pay whoever owns it, or if it's not private, they designate it as a reserve. When they're through with it, if they don't need it for defense anymore, then they're obligated to return it to public domain in as near its natural state as they possibly can by rehabilitation or whatever. Okay, as an example, I know this because I'm a stockholder in Kenai Native Association, and I was studying that status of the federal government military owning things, trying to figure out what it all meant. And I asked them who was to be the judge as to how much work had to be done to return it to its natural state. They said, well, they would hold a hearing in the area and all that. For example, if they got giant bunkers and underground stuff and everything, maybe they would not do that. It would be too expensive to demolish it. So I said, well, if that's the case, why can't you just turn over Wildwood Station to the Kenai Natives as part of the land claim settlement and just consider that it's natural, normal domain? Well, on that property at Kenai, there were apartments for 200 and some people. There's a big $3 million shop facility all equipped with everything you can think of. There's all kinds of stuff. Excuse me. $50 million worth of stuff. So they thought about it and they said, well, hey, really, there's nothing. You know, it's, the government's going to pay money to destroy it, so we'll just turn it over to you. It's, we could do that. Okay, so they did that. But since then, they've started turning other things over to the Indians. Example, the federal building down here, the post office, belongs to Cook Inlet Native Association. We chose that as part of our land selection because it was federally owned. So to answer your question, when they're through with it, you could get it back if you stay on top of it and let them dispose of it to somebody else. Because what it's supposed to do is go back to its original owner, or and the original owner is supposed to get first right of refusal.
Why can't you just go up there and use it like this in warfare? I mean, you get a breach of.
Well, they figure you might. They figure you might damage the facility or something.
John, how has this act met your expectations? You might have had some idea in mind as to what was possible, you know, going into the activity of trying to get a settlement. How do you think it's measured up to the first years?
I was absolutely naive to think that Native leaders could work together after money started flowing. I'm very disappointed in that. As hard as we all worked, you know, every village leader, every regional leader, when we had no money, we worked like dogs. We all took harness, and we all hooked it to the sled, and we all pulled like the dickens as much as we could. Each of us did as much as we could possibly do. There were very few arguments over who should be the boss, who should be the leader. And otherwise, how could I get elected president? So, you know, we worked together. We let the guys that could go ahead the fastest go ahead as fast as they could go. We helped the stragglers along. We really worked as a people, as a team. When the money came, lawyers came, consultants came, educators came, religious people came, and they each grabbed a student, I call it token Indian, Eskimo, and they brainwashed him and said, look, you got to get yours, you're going to ruin it all. Hell with what Wright says, hell with what Hensley says, do your own thing. They built new organizations of leadership, which were frankly incompetent. Got in over their heads, thought they were going to make millions, like Bering Straits. They just didn't know business, and there were, a promoter would get them in the trucking business, another promoter would get them in the hotel business, another promoter would get them into mining, another promoter would get them into something else, and it was beyond them. And by the time they got themselves together, they had lost $30 million. Cook Inlet Native Association, I begged them not to buy hotels. They bought 5 hotels. They lost about $4 million. Tried to change the direction. Nobody would listen. I even ended up in a court battle with the... I was elected by the people on the board of directors of Cook Inlet, Inc., and the Supreme Court threw me off the board because they alleged that I used false and misleading information in a newspaper, and all I said in the newspaper is, how could you lose this much money? Why did you lose this much money? Why buy hotels? why buy a big fancy glass building that's going to, it's impossible to make a profit for 20 years? They say that's misleading. Okay, who made that decision? A guy named Julius Brecht, good Nazi name. The Commissioner of Banking and Securities. Commissioner of Banking and Securities. And what did they do? Good political lesson for you. We fought hard in the Congress to be excluded from the securities and exchange laws because we knew we were ignorant and we knew it would take at least 20 years for us to learn the system. Our theory was that 20 years is a generation, so that anybody that entered school within 20 years could have graduated and learned something before it blew up. So what happens? The minute the land claims passes and Hammond comes in, he gets together with some other people and he personally introduced a bill. They call it the Alaska Little, they call it the Alaska Little Securities Act. Unconstitutional, the state has no jurisdiction, yet they passed a bill, and they passed it in such a manner that if any corporation has more than 500 shareholders or $1 million in assets, that they have to come under this act of full disclosure. So if I wanted to pass out a pamphlet here to you people and state my position on me running for the board of directors of Cook Inlet Native Association, you're almost awkward. I pass that out. If I didn't file that with Brecht first and let him review it and say that it was not false and misleading, they put me in jail. And I say that's unconstitutional, it's totally ridiculous. Hammond had no business doing that, the legislature had no business doing that, but they did it. On the basis of that, the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska threw me off the board, and they got no business in it at all. But I didn't have the money to fight it. They called me a dissident. And I probably am the most knowledgeable and most capable businessman as a stockholder in the entire Cook Inlet region, let alone the Kenai region. But I can't participate. I can't send out one document. I can't buy one ad in the newspaper because Julius Brecht says no. And not only did he say no, but he charged me criminally. And then you know what he did? He came as the judge. And I had to pay. Yeah, I hired Ed Blanco, and I hired Neil Canelli, and I hired another attorney to defend me in front of that kangaroo court with that Nazi who was my accuser and was going to be my judge? You think the system? No, my expectations really are, I'm terribly disappointed. I think that if we get the state out of our business, if we get the school teachers and preachers, Bureau of Indian Affairs out of our business, and if we could throw out the lawyers, and if it could be Indian Eskimo and Aleut to Indian Eskimo and Aleut, and do it the old style, if I'm convincing the people and you don't like it, let's get into it.
Well, I guess maybe I was stepping ahead of you. I decided to quit moving with all that and move into the spirit world.
So anyway, and economically, I think that they're making some progress, but I'm terribly concerned about the status of the land. I think that the only safe place for them to go is into the IRAs. And at least that would give them the total support of all the rest of the Indians throughout the whole United States, and the state couldn't change it, and would take an act of Congress, and if they changed it for the Alaska Natives, they would have to change it for all the Indians throughout the United States, and I think they'd be safer.
I'm thinking about a lot of the old people are kind of mad and they want to cash in on this.
Say it one more time.
Okay. I know that a lot of the elders and stuff are kind of upset because they feel left out. You know, they've got their shares and 20 years and they can cash in and they're going to be gone by then again, and they've got nothing for you know, whatever, nothing for being native. And you've had to do it all over again. You can write in something for them, you know, give them something before they die, you know, something to be proud of or something. And if you could write in, what would it be? Something for the land.
Yeah, you can't legislate morality, and you can't legislate government, so to speak. So Congress wanted very much to do something like that, and we did too. The 5 years of 10% was a token effort in that direction. The discussions in the FN board meetings, the village meetings, and the region meetings was that the people will take care of their own. Now, every village could give them anything they want. And every region could give them everything they want or need. But because of the infusion of the white man law, the state law, the little securities exchange and everything, those of us who would give to the people are being held out on threat of going to jail if we try to change it. In the meantime, the courts and the crooked lawyers and the crooked promoters are interpreting the act to their benefit to deprive the older people. So the only, if I had my way, they would have filed the act and they'd all have everything they want as much as long as they want. I don't mean everything, but they would have decent income for the old, they would have land for the old, and they hand it on to generation, but do it as a tribe. Take care of our own. We could even do it under this act if the people would do it, but they're amending it. Every year they're trying to amend something else, but they can't amend. They challenge in court. Now that money that was to go to the villages from 7J, the village in turn could have given part of it to the elders, but the villages are not getting it.
That depends on whether or not they're profitable.
Or non-profit. But even as a non-profit, they could give it as welfare to the old folks. There's a thousand ways they could give it to them. All they got to do is want to do it. And what the problem is, see, they confuse everybody. You know, what's this non-profit profit? What's this corporate structure? All that. It's alien to the people. What's wrong with a little village of 100 people, of which 50 are children, and 10 are over the age of 65, getting together, having a little potlatch and saying, well, how are you doing, old folks? Well, I need this, I need that. Fine, here you go. You know, give it to them. If they need windows, or if they need better food, or if they need something else, the village could give it to them. They got it. And then the rest of them say, now we're going to just keep working harder, but instead they're greedy. See? They say, oh no, you're not going to give it to so-and-so unless you give it to me. What are you going to do? You want to go down and get drunk? What can you do? So I don't know. I don't have an answer to what I would do If I could be the benevolent dictator, I would be that, but you can't. There's no way to legislate that, I think.
In 40 years from now, say, for some reason, taxes are really high on the land is in a taxable position, you're starting to get suits against it, the Little Commissions Act or whatever that is starts really nailing the corporations hard. At that time, can they back off of everything and then go into IRA or whatever on it down the road, or will they still be liable for all the state taxes and the states decide to dump on and all this and all that? They nullify all that stuff, they're going to lose the land and lose everything.
I, frankly, at this plateau, 10 years in the act, am terrified that speaking to a class like this will turn on a bunch of rednecks, a bunch of chauvinists, a bunch of greedy people to immediately go and try to pass an amendment to prohibit the possibility of ever doing it. As I say, the sooner they do it, the better off we are. If we wait 10 years further, I don't think we'll have that opportunity. I think the climate is good. I think that the Reagan administration is not a terminus administration. Watch him fight them Indians, he's friends in his movies. No, really, I don't think Reagan is anti-Indian. I don't think he's pro-Indian, but I think he's fair. I think he's pro-constitutionalist, and I think he's pro-sovereignty. I think he understands the meaning of the word. A guy like Hammond, he doesn't understand the meaning of sovereignty. He thinks he's a socialist. Matter of fact, he thinks that he should be a benevolent communist and give all of Alaska's resources to everybody in the world. I can't go along with that. I think that if they don't do it, I think that the pressure is going to build. We're going to start talking about it, and I think the legislature is going to get in the act, and I think that Congress is going to get in the act, and they're going to try to stop that possibility.
That's how we lock that solid down.
Yeah.
For 40 years from now.
Because the first paragraph of the act says that this act is intended for a final settlement of all, if any, Aboriginal titles to land, not to create any racially defined enclaves or some such thing. That's what they're talking about. That's terminationist type language. Any new, it says. Well, you have to interpret that as meaning that. In other words, they're saying whatever existed today at the time of the act, we'll live with. And they had to write that in there in order not to alienate the tribes from the lower 48, which also protected the IRAs that were in existence at the time here, of which there are about 68. And they didn't want to create any new ones. And with that clear interpretation on the face, you know, we got maneuvering room right now. But if they throw it to the courts like they're doing this, they'll stall it for 10 years, and we're not going to be able to extend the time. And they'll wipe us out by, what do you call that? Manipulation. Regional corporation can't do that because they're subject to the jurisdiction of the state judiciary. But an IRA can do that. And the region could convey its property to an IRA and then establish its own court system. But only for minor crimes. Under the IRA, all major crimes are still under federal jurisdiction. I've studied the IRA status compared to the corporate status for ever since the bill passed, and I can see nothing in the IRA that would prohibit you from doing everything you're doing in the regional corporation, plus giving you all these other benefits. I don't see any shortcomings that are glaring, except challenges. You know, you're going to have challenges no matter what you do. But on the face of it, I think it's good.
What about that with the IRA constitution? There, the government, or the federal government claims the union government how to do it. And a traditional council can do just the same thing as an IRA council. It doesn't, the point is not as prefabricated.
Well, you're getting some bad advice again from Tamna Chiefs, probably. And from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, the people, like now Jim Savick is the superintendent there, they like to play golf. They got nothing to do with an IRA. All they are is a public servant, a clerk, sitting in an office. The IRA council says, here's what we're going to do. You take it to Savick and you say, here's what we want to do, here's our resolution. He is obligated by law to comply with your constitution and bylaws. It's written in there. All employees of Interior Department shall comply with this constitution and bylaws. The constitution and bylaws says you can do anything you did in the past that's not against federal or territorial law. You can do anything you want that's not against federal or territorial law. So you make your decision, you give it to Savick, and he is a good public servant, getting paid with taxpayers' money, transfers it to Juneau, and Zuni, as a good area director public servant, transfers it to Washington, or makes a decision if he has the authority at that level. And for them to come and tell you what to do is a myth. It's only that people have been brainwashed to think that the Bureau can tell them what to do. And they believe, but it's not true. You don't have to do anything they tell you.
No, I misunderstood though. I'm saying a traditional council has...
IRA is traditional council.
But you're given a package from the GIA saying this is how you incorporate, this is how you do everything. A traditional can come up with an identical package, only it's been done by the tribe.
The traditional council or the traditional group is the only group that can adopt an IRA. They're the only ones. Okay? And once they adopt it, they're the only ones that can govern it. That is the traditional. If they adopt that IRA and they're free to act traditional, it can never be taken away from them without a specific act of Congress, without their written approval, having another meeting and throwing it out. That's the only way to get rid of it is for you to throw it out. A traditional council, as you're reading it, has been extinguished. The property right has been extinguished by the federal government. And they've conveyed that land to your same people as a stop, in the land and everything like that, under state law. So your traditional council is an IRA, or an IRA is your traditional council. You know what I'm trying to say? In other words, for example, here's what we have. The IRA is Arctic Village Venetile, 1,800,000 acres of land, okay? That's the land that the traditional council, IRA, owns. The Village of Arctic has a traditional council for the Village of Arctic. And the Village of Venetai has a traditional council for the Village of Venetai. And they're autonomous. But they have to comply with tribal law. They have to comply with tribal law. But they're traditional, each one. And they don't have a constitution of bylaws, they don't have anything. They're just the people in the village. They have an annual meeting, they elect their chiefs and their council, they hold their meetings. They establish their goals and objectives. They make them known to the IRA council, or to the Bureau, or to the Tamna chiefs, or to anybody. But that's a traditional government. Is that what you meant?
I'm not sure, but I think you just engaged yourself into that traditional government, because they set up elections. And traditionally, you don't have elections, you have a mutual agreement.
Well, depends on what tradition is. Traditionally, every village I ever knew had an election. I mean, that's how they elected their chief. I think they weren't like the queen, where one inherits from the other. The ones that I know, maybe some of them.
Would that, is that true for indigenous? The minimum tax having the profit tax
system? The tax? Yeah. They're leasing oil lands.
Is there any reluctance to do business with the community?
They can't sue. Oh yeah, but we wouldn't do business with them.
On the part of other companies, they're reluctant to do business with your group. They didn't have access to court in case there was a dispute.
Put it this way: wrote to every major and minor oil company that does business in Alaska, and some that don't do business in Alaska, several years ago, and invited them to look at the property and you know, consider bidding on it or leasing. Before land claim, I mean, before the tribe voted to keep the land, Tanah Chief held a public auction out there. Never got one bidder, not one. So we started negotiating with people who become interested, and we ended up dealing with one out there. They paid $1.8 million truck money to explore for a year. They've got, in my opinion, better terms for royalties, et cetera, than the state or the feds or any native corporation that I know of. They signed an agreement that they will abide by all tribal law, constitution and bylaws, that it'll be a violation of the lease if they bring any kind of alcohol or drugs or mind-altering things that are not permissible. Petroleum on a hard rock mineral exploration, they had no problem with it. But they didn't make any selections. So no, I don't think it's a handicap. As a matter of fact, I think it might be an incentive, because industrial development on a reservation, quote, IRA, you have a hell of a tax advantage that you can pass on to industry, but also you don't have to comply with so many stringent restrictions of state and local government. You can make your own. You know, a good example is that the North Slope Borough, they can tax whatever they want. You take the Kenai Borough, they probably have the lowest taxes in Alaska. Well, they do that because they want the industry there. North Slope doesn't care. They don't want people there, so they make the taxes as high as possible, whatever the traffic will bear. That's autonomy, you know, in its own sense. The tribe would have that right, whichever it happened to be, to make their own decision. And they could make it more appealing to investment people.
How do federal agencies like large acts like environmental protection agencies, how do they administer their
We ran into an environmental, well, for example, in order to get the federal funding for the Arctic Village Airport, we had to submit an environmental impact statement, and we had to interview and have hearings for the surrounding communities, which there are none, see, except Vinita and Arctic. So we did all that, and we submitted an environmental impact statement. Then we went to put in our water and sewer. PHS said we had to do the same thing, and we did it. And then they said that they had a deal with the state, that the state would have jurisdiction over inspection for environmental impact. And then we drew the line. We said, no, we will not have your water and sewer. We don't want your money if that's the case. They never challenged it, and the state didn't bother us. The state came in and inspected our we just got a few rooms and a little lunch counter in Arctic Village, no water, sewer, anything. Pack the water and carry out the sewer. They came in and with all their lists and said, you got to have this, that, and the other, stainless steel this and stoves this and all that. And we told them they were trespassing. And they went back and wrote us a big letter and said that they were going to send enforcement officers up there. And we said, tell them to come on in. We'll arrest them because they're trespassing. They said, well, explain it to us. So we did. So they wrote us a letter back and they said, oh, we understand now. You're just like Mount McKinley. He said, you got it, man. No state jurisdiction down there.
Any more questions?
Who took over after you were ousted from AFM?
As a matter of fact, Dad, I got some pictures here. I want you to see somebody.
I even got a legal brief from an attorney that told him how to do it.
You know what, Don, your mistake was?
What?
Why did you sign that deal to have that AFM convention? I always thought that was a strategic mistake when you agreed to
let you guys convention. In on my convention. The question was, see, we had a Alaska Federation of Natives Association, right? Before any of us natives knew anything about a non-profit corporation, in order to get money from the foundations and so forth, they wouldn't give the money to the association unless it was through a non-profit corporation that had a tax-exempt status. So we formed AFN Inc., determined that AFN Inc. would have a board of directors made up of the 12 leaders from each of the regions, president of each region, but that the president would be elected at large. So I was the president at large. These guys couldn't stand the heat, so they figured they had to get rid of me some way. So they figured they had to dissolve the association in order to make the corporation live with only 12 people being the powerhouse. And that's the way it still is. That's one of the reasons they're having more trouble than they should be having, because they don't have democratic conventions.
Well, here, look here. This is, remember that that meeting down at the Tanana Chiefs? Yeah. Yeah, here's where you are.
I got some
pictures from
first hand.
See, that's the. Here's the two pulpits. Well, one thing Don and I have never had much difficulty in getting together and talking. And when the chips were down, we basically supported each other, right? When it was absolutely essential.
When it was something that was for the people, we stuck together.
Yeah, right. Anyway. Well, I'm really glad you were able to make the class.
Thank you.
I wanted the students to at least have a chance to ask you whatever they wanted to and meet the personality that had a great deal to do with, you know, what we finally ended up with, warts and all. I mean, not on you, but on the act. So thanks a lot.
I appreciate it.
I hope to have a few more people come by before the class is over. And I want you to know that I never really spent that much time thinking about this university and its role in trying to convey the kind of information we're trying to through this class. To me, the Alaska Native Studies program is just, you know, rather minuscule, and it doesn't have near the support that it should have, you know, in the structure here, nor has it gotten the kind of support it should have within the Native community, and to me, the non-Native community that wants to understand what's been happening and what is happening. So I took Barton to lunch down in Juneau with a couple of the regents and somebody from the AFN, trying to impress upon him what I think is an important program. That is, for any Alaskan, whether he's Native or non-Native, who wants to spend part of his life working either in the bush, whether it's educating the Native people, whether he's interested in working in corporations that we have ownership of or an interest in. You know, I think having the Native history as a background and as a focal point is essential. Otherwise, if you're studying business or education or something else as a sort of the normal course of events, then you have to strenuously try to draw it and make it relevant. you know, draw it in and make it relevant to you and your particular interest. So I was trying to get Barton to understand that we need, you know, support from the Board of Regents and from the administration to expand the program. I mean, and tie it in with Anchorage, because right now there is absolutely no connection, you know, and no mutual planning on personnel or material for the courses. You know, both between the community college, say in Anchorage, and University of Alaska Anchorage, and here. And I think it's unheard of. Here's a chance for the university to really look good and do something that's practical and relevant. So, you know, you can't help, you know, you just can't stop being a politician in this system. You know, if you believe in something, you know, you have to keep kind of working at it. Well, I'm not much of a judge because I don't even know how many courses they have down there in Anchorage. You know, all I know is that the people, you know, are there, right? I mean, there's a lot of people that could be participating in a whole variety of courses. You know, whether it's business, whether it's law, you know, whether it's politics, whether it's history, you know, from the Native perspective. You know, they're all working around and about there. So, I mean, Anchorage has a fantastic opportunity to do it if they wanted to. But here, of course, you have this. I think you have. I don't know what the ratio is in terms of students, but I know there's a lot of Native students here, you know, who are interested. Non-Native people who have an interest in what's happening. But and of course, the main campus is here. And so I think this, I sort of threatened Barton a little bit. You know, I said, look, if you don't make it relevant up here, then maybe we'll just have to take our students somewhere where it is relevant, you know, where they can get what they need out of the system and the kind of mental stimulation that's required, you know, to keep people interested. Because that's important.
Did he say like where?
Did I say where?
Did he say like where?
Nah, no, he didn't. He didn't want to bear to think about it. But
and if he did, what would you have said? Like where?
Well, I mean, almost anywhere. I mean, we'll take them to Harvard, to Stanford, to University of Washington, wherever. Some small school that, you know, if they want the students and they got what we need, you know, APU.
Well, I was wondering.
Actually, I've even thought of talking to Glenn Olds. He's called me several times, and I'm frankly not, you know, I haven't been, you know, interested.
You'd be a fascinating combination.
Well, mainly because I was a little perturbed, you know. He's tried so hard to find the money to keep his little operation going that he's sort of willing to compromise, I thought, because remember, he got like, I don't know, $100,000 from ARCO or someplace to sort of convey great things about private enterprise, right? That was the key words. Well, to me, a university is designed to open up your mind, not close it, right? I mean, if you're going to teach economics, you show the communistic system, you know, you talk about the socialist, you talk about the capitalist, and you let the ideas, you know, ferment, and you make your choices. Like, you don't shut off this part of your brain because somebody's giving you a few bucks over here. You know, but maybe I should have him explain it to me. But I think that we have to have a relevant perspective, I think, to keep people's interest. You know, because I spent most of my life going to school trying to figure out what was happening because I really couldn't identify with American history. You know, I felt like I was on the receiving end of these terrible policies, you know. And I tried, but it didn't work. I mean, I didn't become a white Southerner. It just didn't work. Anyway, get to work on your papers. And show me that you know something by the end of this course. Thank you.